Well, I'm glad to see you all have faces. One way you can see the end of suffering sometimes is when an unpleasant and painful experience passes away, and then you have that experience of relief. Thank you for being so cooperative in keeping the community safe. I really appreciate that. I know it was not what you were looking forward to. So tonight I'm going to talk about a number of things, but they're going to have as a central theme wise effort and what it is, how it's applied, what you need to do in order to be making wise effort. But I'd like to start with a story of the Buddha. So it said that after the Buddha awakened, after the night where he saw very deeply into cause and effect, he came to understand how suffering comes to be and how it could unbind. That after that awakening, that great awakening under the Bodhi tree, he spent a number of days just experiencing the bliss of that awakening and thinking further about what he had seen, its implications. But interestingly, even though he was altruistically inclined, he didn't initially think he was going to be teaching. Because after he figured things out for himself and found full release of the mind, it came to me that wow, you know, this Dharma is subtle and deep and difficult to penetrate. It's like, I don't know, if you try to teach this, if you put it out there, are they going to get it? You know, are they going to want it? So he was in that state of kind of pondering that and perhaps being a little disinclined to actually teach. And the story goes that a celestial being saw that the Buddha was disinclined to teach and came to him and basically asked him to teach for the benefit of beings. And it was said then the Buddha kind of like looked around with his divine eye, with his psychic powers, and found that there were beings who had but little dust in their eyes, meaning they were deluded. Yes, it's true. And they would never figure it out on their own. Yes, it's true. But if they heard the teachings and practiced the teachings, they could too could awaken and free their minds. So once he realized that offering the Dharma was not going to be fruitless, out of compassion, he taught for many years up until his death, and even at the point of death was still offering teachings to his disciples as he passed away. So to me, one of the great wonders of the teachings of the Buddha is how a human being could take their own experience of awakening and reverse engineer it and put it into words, into a framework of explanation that's very specific and very comprehensive, and turn and give it to others as something that is actionable, something that we can actually do ourselves. So those of you who know some of the structure of the Buddha's teachings recognize that a lot of it is offered, or a lot of it is conveyed in the form of lists, right? Some of you know, there's the Four Noble Truths, and there's the Eightfold Path, and there's the Four Elements, and there's the Three Characteristics, and there's the Five Hindrances, and there's the Five Aggregates, and there's the Seven Factors of Awakening, and right, there's the Paramis, and right, lists of things. But not only does he offer these lists of things that provide the context and the path of practice, but he also interrelates these pieces. He says, well, this is what needs to be done, and this is how you do it. Let me chunk it out for you. Let me start by framing it up for you and tell you how one thing intersects with another, how one cultivation supports another. So do people know that the phrase reverse engineering? Am I the only dweeby person that knows about this? Okay, so I'll give you an example. So with an original invention, say something like diesel motor or something like that, the first person that came up with that put it together in a very original way, right? There was something new in what they understood, and well, maybe if I do this and I do this, but then it needs to have oxygen, but it needs to have fuel, but it'll need a spark, right? They put it together first time. But once that was put together, that original, other people could come along and they could look at that, and in some cases they could take it apart for themselves, and they could see, oh, I see what this guy is doing. I see, okay, yeah, okay, pistons, yeah, I get it. That does this, and then this does this. Oh, spark, yeah, that sets the fuel on fire, and that drives the pistons, and the pistons do this, and that turns this, right? I see what's going on there. And a lot of this goes on in the everyday world, right? Like some corporation or some scientist or some inventor will develop something, and this is what patents are about, right? Trying to preserve an ownership right in something unique that one invented. But the Buddha didn't patent it. So he gave it away. So he said, okay, this is what goes into freeing the heart and mind. This is what goes into awakening. Let me explain it to you. I'll start at the beginning. So his initial teachings were the teachings of the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path. So the Four Noble Truths, I won't go into so much tonight. We may have a talk on that. But the last step of the Four Noble Truths is the Eightfold Path. Now, path. That's really interesting because it sounds linear, right? It sounds like you do one step and then you do the next step and you do the next step and the next step. And then, and it is set up in a very logical, sequential frame, but we actually develop and practice the Eightfold Path as a totality. So it's more like a hologram where each part of it reflects the rest of it. So it needs to be read together as a totality. So I'm going to say some things about the Eightfold Path, especially as it pertains to wise effort, which is the step number 6 on the Eightfold Path. The first two steps of the Eightfold Path are what's called wise view and wise intention. So part of wise view, the first step, is a repetition of the Four Noble Truths. So I will leave that to the side. You'll hear about that later. But the second part of the headline, the number one step, is what's called mundane wise view, where the Buddha makes a very important distinction between qualities of the heart mind that we want to let go of and those we want to develop. So the Buddha says, if you want to suffer more and sink further into delusion, then you would cultivate delusion, aversion, and craving. Those are really linked into suffering and into your misunderstanding, your dysfunctional understanding of how reality works. But if you want to get on the upside in terms of how reality works, you will cultivate generosity, loving kindness, and compassion and wisdom. So there's this axis that he sets up right at the beginning. And that axis carries through and is implemented through all the rest of the steps of the Eightfold Path teaching. So the second step of the Eightfold Path is what's called wise intention, wise intention. And I talked about that a little bit yesterday when I talked about the cultivation of metta. So sometimes it's called wise thought. So wise intention. And this has to do with the cultivation of renunciation, which is a mind that is generous, shares easily, does not crave, and the cultivation of goodwill and compassion. So he says, this is the attitudinal frame you're in when you're practicing. This is the context for your efforts, and these qualities are part of what you bring forward and employ when you're practicing. So there'll be some more about this a little later on. So the next three steps, wise speech, wise action, wise livelihood. So if we're practicing those, we're practicing non-harming. We're practicing wisdom. We're practicing compassion. We're practicing non-craving, right? And this is at the behavioral level. You know, actions that we might do, you know, bad talking, like slander and cruel speech, lying, that kind of stuff. Then what's largely the precepts, wise action with a few other things in there. And then wise livelihood, how you make your jingle. Don't do it in ways that cause harm, right? Don't profit by causing harm. Don't enter into certain professions because they're harmful. They cause suffering to yourself and others. And here again, this is an implementation of this wise intention, wise speech, wise action, wise livelihood, and above that, wise view, wise intention. So what's the thing with wise? And why does that keep coming up as part of the description? Well, what would the flip of wise be? The flip of wise, the antonym would be unwise, dumb, counterproductive, dysfunctional. I had to figure out this quality of mind from a mainstream perspective when I offered some teachings for IMS online in March. I know some of you were in that class. Thank you for not being deterred from coming to this retreat. It was a little bit of a stretch. I mean, it was a different way than I've ever taught before. But one of the things I did was to actually like go into dictionaries and stuff and take a look at, well, what's wise? What is it, what are they talking about? So some of the definitions that I dredged up were interesting. So the power of judging rightly and following the soundest course of action based on knowledge, experience, understanding, good judgment, sagacity. The combination of experience, knowledge, and careful judgment. So I would say you could basically take the word wise out there and stick in strategic. The Buddha is saying all the way through his teachings that this way moves you, develops you in the direction that you want to go if you want to be free, empowered, and happy. This is how to look at things. This is what to do. This is what to forego. This is how to train your heart. This is how to train your mind. Do this, and your understanding will grow. Your span of internal freedom will grow. Your wholesome states and qualities will grow. Your strength of mind will grow. Everything that you would want as a human being in terms of your personal development and your functionality as a person in the world will grow. Do this, don't do that. Do this, don't do that. So the understanding in the Buddhist teachings is that we're actually liberated by wisdom. It's wisdom that frees the mind. And wisdom is actually a quality of mind. It's called the wisdom factor that can arise in the mind and be strengthened in the mind by practice. In insight meditation practice, those of you who know the teachings of the seven factors of awakening might know that the quality of investigation, which is the second of the seven factors of awakening, that quality of investigation, of looking carefully into the momentary experiences that we're having with the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path as our context, that is the wisdom factor operating within the practice. So we've done the wise view section of the Eightfold Path, the sila portion of the path, ethical conduct. So now let's talk about six, because this is really where we should spend most of our time this evening. I said the understanding of skillful and unskillful is the foundation, is foundational to the whole path. So when we get to wise effort and how it's described, this is spelled out again. So the Buddha describes wise effort in terms of the four great endeavors. Four great endeavors. And the first of these is to avoid or prevent unwholesome states from arising. In other words, try not to have the bad stuff come up. So, if you consider the practice of ethical conduct, for instance, that would be an example of one steering away from the active performance of greed, aversion, and delusion, right? On the level of self-restraint, behavioral self-restraint. In order to totally avoid or prevent unwholesome states from arising, one would need to be an arhat, would need to be a completely liberated human being for that to none of those states to ever arise. However, these states can also be avoided by strong, continuous mindfulness. And this is one of the reasons why mindfulness is emphasized so much within the practice tradition. Because if mindfulness is there and it's strong, it serves to suppress the arising of unwholesome states of mind. Now, on this question of the arising of unwholesome states of mind, one thing that you need to understand is that the mind has a lot of different layers. And I'm not talking about the brain, although I'm sure that's part of it too. But the eruption or the arising of unwholesome states of mind is kind of like the surface, a more surface manifestation of underlying tendencies of mind. And these underlying tendencies of mind towards delusion are called the fetters. So they're not directly visible, but they're operative under certain circumstances. So the Buddha says something like, the mind, O monks, is brilliant, but it is visited by adventitious defilements. Adventitious defilements. So what does that mean, adventitious? So that seems to suggest something like, okay, under certain circumstances, these things can break through, right? Under certain circumstances, these can erupt. And you know for yourself, just in your regular walking around life, under certain circumstances, more of this arises, right? Under certain circumstances, we're more likely to get angry or scared or greedy or deluded. So, the fetters are only uprooted if one has attained the fourth stage of awakening, which is to be an arhat. Then there's no more substrate to ever permit those kinds of states to arise again. So in the meantime, we steer away from those states. We try to behave in an ethical manner. We try to summon mindfulness and other wholesome states. We try not to inadvertently create the adventitious circumstances that would allow these to burst forth and control our minds. So the second of the four great endeavors is to overcome or let go of or mitigate unwholesome states when they're present. And a huge amount of meditation practice is in this area, right? So when Roxanne was talking last night about the hindrances, that's what she was talking about. You're sitting there, you're as mindful as you can be at the moment, and then all of a sudden something starts to happen that seems like it's getting in the way of you being able to be mindful, and now there's some kind of struggle going on in your mind, and you know, you keep thinking about lunch, and just then you want your phone, and then, you know, it's just like one thing tumbles into another, and it's like, where's the breath? And it's like, I don't want the breath, I want to get out of here. It's like, okay, that's the arising of a hindrance or a series of hindrances there. A lot of this practice is about developing skill in recognizing the presence of a hindrance and knowing what to do with it then. Meaning, what kind of attention or frame to bring with that? Yes, mindfulness is part of it, but even that, what more specifically can be done about the presence of a hindrance? So when Roxy was talking, she mentioned particular remedies for particular ones, right? Particular things you could do with particular ones. And I know in your practice meetings you've probably gotten some of that as well. But just to speak a little bit about this one, recognition is the first thing. Because they're most dangerous and disabling when you don't recognize their presence. So to learn to recognize them is really good. If you don't recognize it, then that means that there's a mindfulness collapse which has happened. Right? The practice with these particular hindrances takes place when there's some mindfulness. There's enough there to recognize that it's a hindrance, and maybe the hindrance is winning and the mindfulness is weak, and maybe you do something with your mindfulness in relationship to the hindrance, and then the mindfulness is meeting the hindrance, and it can investigate the hindrance, and then maybe it subdues the hindrance. But it can be a battle, as you may have noticed. So there are a number of different remedies that you can use. One is to actually, if the hindrances are weak, to actually ignore them. You know, keep on keeping on with the breath or something if there's a mild hindrance there. Another thing that one could do would be to bring forward the opposite. For instance, if there's a lot of aversion in the mind and you've got some connection to metta and a metta practice, maybe you do some metta for a while, right? You douse the fire with water, so to speak. But a primary aspect of working with a hindrance in a Vipassana practice is you actually investigate it. You take mindfulness and you turn it towards the hindrance that you've recognized, and you ask mindfulness to check it out. Like, what is a state? What is aversion? What is it exactly now that it's here? And so some of the things one would check out would be something like, is it pleasant or is it unpleasant? Or more neutral. Are there thoughts there? Are there thoughts there? Okay, aversion is there. What's the feeling of aversion in the body when it's there and it's strong? Because strong emotions generally have a correlate set of body sensations. So, for instance, I know for myself, when aversion is there and it's strong, one of the things that I notice is, well, first of all, there's energy. It's kind of like, you know, there might be a feeling of heat, you know, fire, certain places. Like, I might notice, you know, my arms get kind of tight. Maybe my hands get a little clenchy. There's almost like an impulse sometimes, if it's really strong, like to almost like get up out of the seat, kind of like one of those, don't make me come over. So you can see what's happened right there with that way of working with a recognized hindrance. So now, instead of the hindrance being there and dominating the mind and mindfulness collapsing, you're using the mindfulness that you have on hand, and by turning it towards the experience, you're actually strengthening mindfulness. You're seeing, well, what is this thing that normally, when it's really strong, would make me do something stupid? What is this, right? Oh, it's a state that is opening like this. This thought, this feeling tone, this set of emotions, this is what it is. So this is all in regard to practicing with hindrances, the second of these four great endeavors. The third of these great endeavors is to arouse what is wholesome. Like to bring it forward, to actively bring it up. So if you remember, seems like a long time ago, the first day of meditation's instructions in the hall where you were, I was offering that. One of the things I said was to become aware of the people around you who are fellow wayfarers and to, you know, silently wish them well. Right? May you practice well today. May your practice unfold with ease or whatever. Right? Thoughts of loving kindness, thoughts of letting go, thoughts of compassion. We can bring these forward. We can bring forward in the practice these qualities of the heart called the paramis, the paramitas. And this is another one of the Buddha's lists. Generosity, morality, renunciation, wisdom, diligence, patience, truthfulness, resolve, loving kindness, equanimity. Virya is a very wholesome quality of mind that's very much involved with the practice of wise effort. In fact, this whole section of the path is sometimes called samavirya. Right effort, but virya is this word that means a kind of like, I'm going to do it. Not deterred by difficulty. Right? Committed. If it's hard, that's okay. Going to persist. Going to do it. Going to stay engaged. And the Buddha emphasizes this quality of heart a lot in practice. And he talks about effort a lot. Because in a certain kind of way, we're required to go upstream against some of our conditioned tendencies of mind and body. You may have noticed that already. So, you know, it's like, yeah, I don't really feel like going in there. I don't want to go in the hall. Huh? Okay, would that be a hindrance? Well, maybe. The I don't wanna mind, that doesn't sound like fun to me. I don't want to do that. Virya would say, well, thanks for the opinion. We're going. Here we go. In we go. And we'll sit down and we'll watch the temper tantrum for a while. We'll watch Don't Want Mind do its thing. So wise attention to things, wise intention, inclining the mind towards goodwill, for instance, inclining the mind to be present. Arousing energy. You know, when you're falling asleep repeatedly and you decide, okay, this is what we're doing. We're standing up and we're opening our eyes. This is the royal way. I don't know if you ever talk to yourself that way. But no, we're not doing it, you know, like kind of like we're twins or something, but no, we're not. Nope. And then the last of these is to sustain and develop the wholesome. So the development of the Brahmavihara is the development of the paramis, the development of mindfulness itself, the development of path understanding by studying the Eightfold Path, the development of wise concentration. Those of you who know the structure of the Eightfold Path know that after wise effort comes wise mindfulness and then wise concentration. It's interesting, isn't it, that by the time you actually get to the meditative pieces, the samadhi portion of the Eightfold Path, there's been all of this other stuff that's been highlighted first. So this is the Buddha telling you all this stuff, the practice that you do on the cushion, this happens within a framework. This is part of a system of practice. In concentration, in order to be wise concentration, for instance, is held within the context of this path. So when we practice and sustain wise concentration, that supports the development of other wholesome qualities because it has the property of actually suppressing the hindrances. If the mind is very concentrated in a wise way, the hindrances don't arise. Now, that's not a bad thing. It's temporary, right? It's dependent on the state of wise concentration being strong, but it gives us an experience of what it's like to have a mind that is free from the manifestation of gross hindrances. Wow. Temporarily free from torments. That's not a bad ride. And when that concentration is there at that level, then when the mind is turned to insight practice or to vipassana, there's much more capacity to actually see deeply into the vipassana practice and to clearly see the three characteristics and impermanence. Because there aren't distractions in the field, right? The hindrances are temporarily suppressed. So you don't go shooting off into side trips and, you know, wrecks as often. So let me talk a little bit about the kind of effort that we're talking about here. I've just talked about the four great endeavors. That's kind of like the practice field. It has to do with taking that binary of what's to be cultivated and what's to be let go of. And what's to be let go of, you make the effort to let go off, and the ones that are to be cultivated, you make the effort to cultivate, right? And he says that very specifically. So that's a through line in the teachings. But let's look at what kind of effort is really called for. So a first piece is committed and sustained. Committed and sustained. I spoke earlier about this word virya, that implies this heroic attitude of mind in regard to the cultivation. So one of the images that I've seen used in, I think this was used in one of the commentaries, is it's like a strong man standing in the middle of a river, raging river, and he reaches back and he takes the hand and the arm of another person to bring them across the river, through the floods. You kind of get the picture, right? Some burly dude out there, I can do it. Come on, we got to cross. Come on, let's go. We can do it. Give me your hand. Virya in action. I'll give you another image. A woman giving birth, right? You're in the middle of it. It's like, okay, there's only one way this is going to end, right? We ain't going back to square one. It's like, this is happening. Got to do it. Going to do it. Okay. Breathe. Push, 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 right? Got to do it. Want to do it. Will do it. That kind of effort. So, committed and sustained. So the another piece of this is well aligned with the teachings, right? So that tells you that knowing the context is important, because then you understand the task. You understand the big picture in which you're practicing and why, for instance, certain instructions are given. So, you ever have the experience of watching or being a person who's trying to learn or trying to do something for the first time? So let me give you an example. So in the States here, we have this way of teaching young kids how to play baseball, and part of playing baseball is this thing called batting, which involves a ball that's being thrown at them, and then they have this bat. And they swing, and they try to hit the ball. And then if they hit the ball good, then they get to run. Okay, there's a whole bunch, but we don't need to go into that. But how would you start with, like, a four-year-old to teach them how to bat? T-ball, right? You know what that is? There's like a little stand that rests on the ground over home plate, and the adult actually puts what's usually a bigger ball than they would normally play with and of a different consistency on it, and then shows the kid how to stand a certain distance, gives them the bat, shows them how to hold the bat, and shows them how to hit it. So if you watch this going on, you'll see things that are interesting and sometimes amusing. So the natural thing to do is, kids try to give it a mighty whack, right? Like sometimes they'll like completely miss it and just like spin around in a circle and fall down, right? So it's trial and error. Eventually, just by trying, and then they pay attention to they're learning from the effects of how they try. Eventually they make some contact with the ball, right? And it does something. Maybe it just dribbles off the tee and falls down. But eventually they kind of pick it up. So, how do you learn how to do anything? You kind of get the instructions or have the principles explained to you, and then you get in there and try to do it. So you could say in a certain way, what you're doing here is immersion experiential learning. You've gotten the instructions about what to notice, how to notice it, how to sustain that kind of attention, what to do when it starts going wrong, meaning mindfulness collapses or a strong hindrance is there, and then you're asked to sustain that. I can remember once at the three-month retreat, I was talking about what it's like to teach people on that long retreat. And the image as I was talking came to me. I said, you know, it's like being, teaching at this is like being a driving instructor. Okay. So, you know, a driving instructor, you know, gives you the principles. Here's the wheel. Here's the directionals. Here's the gas. Here's the brake. Here's the principles. You stay between the lines. You do this and you do that. They kind of give you the download. And being a Dharma teacher is a little bit like that, except we're not in the car with you. So it's like we're outside the car, like telling you. And we knock on the window and say, roll. Let me know at the next practice meeting how it went. So you learn yourself, right? You learn yourself by paying attention to what happens, what you're experiencing, what happens when you attend to it in a certain kind of way. What happens? And then this will arise, and then you try to be with it, attend to it with mindfulness, know it, keep that thread of continuity going there. Oh, now this is happening. Okay, well, what is it? Is it hindrance? Oh, see, what should I look at? Oh, Vedana, no. What's that? Which one is it? It's no. Do I need more energy? No, I think I've got... Right? But this is your own learning. This is how you learn to make contact with the stream of arising and passing experiences, which is your life. Right? So sometimes you're like the kid working with T-ball. Right? In the early stages, it can feel like that. But just like that kid, you pay attention, you keep doing it, you learn. So you don't learn by like turning on yourself and berating yourself. It's like, oh, it's like a T-ball. Why would you expect you would be good at it if you haven't done it? So, well aligned with the teachings, patient. So there's a piece here about integrity of effort that's related to skillfulness. We keep engaged, we keep showing up, regardless of how it's going. Sometimes when people think of effort, they think of it mostly along the polarity of like try hard or, you know, don't try at all, like lazy ass, you know, kind of like. And you think the middle path is like somewhere in the middle, like, yeah, kind of try. But I don't think that's really the primary axis, because what wise effort can look like could be very different depending on what you're actually experiencing. There can be points in the practice where basically one doesn't have to try to do anything in particular in relationship to what's being known. The mind is just knowing its experience moment by moment as the experience unfolds. There's nothing more to be done. Mindfulness is there. There aren't really hindrances. One is just seeing and knowing things as they arise and pass away, present themselves, and then seemingly turn to something else. And there are other times where you have to really kind of bring in the yang, right? Be more assertive, like, no, we're not going to just go down that path again. No, I don't think we are. We're going to, this is the royal way. No. So what the practice looks like in terms of the how you make effort depends on the totality of the circumstances that are present in your practice. And how do you know what's indicated? Because you're connected closely to your immediate experience. And within that immediate experience is the field of information that you need in order to understand what's appropriate. So there is a whole system intelligence that is you. It's there in the field. So another piece of this is, and I've talked about this in my practice groups that we've had so far, is the importance of internalizing the instructions, right? There are many different ways that one can practice, many different sets of instructions, you know, a lot of different systems of training, even within, you know, our tradition, which is founded mostly on the early Buddhist teachings. Even within what we offer here at IMS, there's different strands of teaching. I mean, there's the Asi, there's Utejaniya, there's, you know, Dipama, there's Thai Forest tradition. So there are different ways that one can instruct meditation. So in current times, of course, you also have apps, you have online stuff, you have podcasts, you have a lot of different things, which is good. And it's a little bit of a potpourri, right? So it is useful and beneficial to actually, like, at a certain point, pick one horse for a while and learn how to ride it, right? Figure out what set of instructions kind of clicks with you and practice with that for a good period of time until you get some level of mastery with them. Meaning that you've internalized them to the point where you know what to do with what you're experiencing. Right? It's like, oh, okay, this is this state. All right. I can see that more energy is needed here to investigate. Right? Or, oh, I can see the mind is actually experiencing a wholesome state. Let me invite that state to arise and strengthen. Oh, it's doubt. Yeah, again, I see. Well, what's the instruction for working with doubt? Oh, the instruction working with doubt is actually to withdraw attention from the state of doubt and actually turn attention in real time towards something physical that can be known in real time. Right? So all of these ways of working are things that you can learn how to do. So as you become more aware in a consistent way of your mind stream as it manifests itself, as it becomes visible to you, you'll be able to make a spontaneous, appropriate, skillful response when required. And as I said earlier, sometimes it won't even be required. Sometimes, if the mindfulness is strong, there's nothing to do. It's just things arising and passing away, being known, deepening the wholesome factors are present and they're deepening. You don't need to get in there and tinker. And just to say one word about this idea of mind stream. So we talk in the practice about there being six sense doors. Have you heard that teaching before? There's six sense doors. We may have referenced it a little bit here. So there's the anything that we experience as a human being involves consciousness, connecting with a sense base, and from that an experience, a sensory experience can arise, right? For instance, hearing. Ear door. Get this little image of like a little garage door opening up. Ear door. Sound, waves, ear door, hearing, consciousness, hearing. The three come together, the experience of hearing. Everything that we experience arises with a sense base. At a certain point in the meditation practice, one can have the experience of, instead of there being kind of like separate things out there that are like coming to you and then you know them or you need to go out to get them, to see them or feel them or smell them or whatever. There's more of an experience of there being mindfulness or consciousness, and within this field of this, there arises a stream of experiences. Hearing, seeing, tasting, touching, smelling, thinking, remembering, planning, emoting, all the rest of it. So it's an amazing, amazing thing to cultivate the mind in this kind of way. In a certain kind of way, to awaken to how we actually are set up as human beings, how we actually function. I don't know if you remember, but on the first day, when I was talking about the cell phone renunciation practice, I said something like, well, you know, this is your opportunity to let go of that, all of that for a while, and to come back to yourself, to come back to yourself, to inhabit yourself for a while, to be yourself, to be at home. So this practice is very much about that. Learning how to understand our subjectivity and how it's constructed and finding a wise relationship to it, which is a whole different thing than the familiar experience of being lost and at odds with and struggling against what we experience in the immediate, or kind of like blinking in and out of any kind of contact with our immediate experience. Just being lost in sensate experience, or lost in thoughts, lost in emotions, kind of confused about whether we're in the present or when we're in the future, or whether we're in the past. It's all kind of like swirling around as like one big old mix. No. Here and now, just this, presence with what's being known, wise relationship with what's being known, the mind purifying itself through clear seeing, sustained clear seeing, supported by mindfulness. So this is the teaching of the Buddha as I understand it. So, you're doing something pretty deep here, you know. Radically simple and very deep and potentially transformative. So, a lot of respect for you. I know you're doing it too. I've been spying on you. May the practice that we've done here together by offering and hearing the Dhamma be a cause and condition for our own awakening and that of all beings everywhere. May we all awaken together.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.